The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this, the 16th day of November 2025. We look to our left and see our esteemed engineer, Brian Graves, seated in the control room. He is at the helm of this ship. Right, Brian? He is large and in charge. I'm glad you tuned in tonight, wherever you may be. And, of course, if you have the TuneIn app, we are listenable all over the place. So we got a great show in store for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in a guest you've been waiting for. We have not had such a buzz at the station, folks, since we welcomed Ted Giannoulis, the San Diego Chicken, to our air. It's been so exciting around here. He has a new book out. It's called Me Here, You There. We will be speaking to the schmoozer himself. Steve Summers will join us. In the second half, we will speak to legendary Hall of Famer, the immortal New York Ranger defenseman. No Icelanders tonight, folks. The great Brad Park will speak with us. So relax, enjoy the show, get under the covers. Now, it's too early for that for some people, but not for me, that's for sure. But you there, we've got some great sports talk ahead waiting for you. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page. It's called The Talk of New York Sports. You'll find sports information, show information, some great picks, just a plethora of amazing stuff. So stop by, take a look at it. You can also follow me on X. It's at B Donahue, WGBB, all one word. And if you miss one of our shows, don't worry, because they're all out on the website the next day and can be heard at www.sportstalknewyork.com. You catch up anytime. Well, our first guest, he is a legendary figure in New York sports. He graced our lives through his overnight shifts on WFAN. He's dubbed Captain Midnight. He enthralled and entertained us each night, schmoozing S-P-O-R-T-S. He has a new book out from our friends at Triumph in Chicago. It's titled Me Here, You There, My 3 Decades Overnight Under the Cover Schmoozing Sports as Captain Midnight for WFAN. I'm happy to welcome to the show tonight Steve Summers. Steve, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor. Yes, you're Long Island. Yes, you probably say Islanders instead of Icelanders, but I heard the Icelanders there, no doubt, to honor me. But thank you very much, Bill, for having me on something that I was looking forward to, because you are giving me the opportunity to give the shameless plug
exactly
on my book that comes out on November 25th. So, again, thanks for having me.
No worries, Stephen. Yeah, we do mispronounce Islanders sometimes and slip, but that's to be expected from the people out here in Long Island. Now, you are from the San Francisco Bay Area, and you went to UCal Berkeley. Peace, man.
Yes, also San Francisco State University. Cal Berkeley was something I put on my resume because of some of the summer classes that I took there in communications, but I actually got the degree from San Francisco State University, where I happened to be the sports director of the campus radio station, the music director, and who was on my podcast with me about a week ago, was an original writer of the Rolling Stone magazine, Ben Fong Torres. And if you ever saw the movie Almost Famous,
yeah,
with Kate Hudson,
uh-huh,
you know, this was like sort of autobiography of Cameron Crowe as a kid traveling on the road with rock bands. And then he would call into Rolling Stone filing his stories, touring with rock bands around the country. And in the movie, the Asian actor taking the stories from the young Cameron Crowe was Ben Fong-Torres, and just a terrific writer and broadcaster himself. But nonetheless, yes, and Berkeley, the Golden Bears, of they're not a very good football team, to be honest with you, but and they're not even anymore. There's anything like a Pac-10. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're playing in conferences 3,000 miles away, Stanford and California. But I never followed, other than having to do what I was doing with sports. The bottom line is I had more fun when I was just about graduating from high school, when I was doing high school sports on a top 40 radio station and saw in high school play football, O.J. Simpson. I saw Dan Fouts play football and Mike Holmgren. And it was then, back in the 1960s, when the Fearless Forecaster was born. And as you know, Bill, Fearless really came to America to escape the oppression of soccer.
Exactly.
And, yes, and then was made famous, of course, by FDR, the president, when he once said, the only thing we have to fear is Fearless himself. And and to this day, Fearless lives in Manhattan off FDR Drive on the corner of Happy and Healthy.
Exactly, yeah. And small world, but they're almost famous, Steve. That's great to know. Next time I catch that movie, it's on one of the cable stations at least once a week. I will check.
Oh yeah, no,
I will check that out.
A lot, yeah.
And I also read that you were a PA announcer for the San Francisco Warriors.
Well, the Warriors girls team. At the time, yeah, not the varsity, but before the Warriors would play, I was doing play-by-play and public address announcing for the Warriors girls basketball team. It was one of the first all-girls basketball teams in America. The owner of the Warriors at that time was a fellow by the name of Franklin Muley. He wore a bouffet and a scarf around his neck and smoked a pipe. He was a real character, and he was a little bit of a maverick, wanting to do different things and wanting to establish women as basketball players. So in a way, he was one of the first, and I won the audition for it. It wasn't hard pronouncing their names. They weren't foreign names,
right,
like hockey names, where you would have to help me out.
Yeah, understood, Steve. Yeah. July 87 comes around, Steve. WAFAN, the inception of that station. All sports, never been done before. You get the midnight shift. What are some of your thoughts going into WFAN?
I was pushing in my pants. I was so nervous and worried. And on the very first night in October, July 1 of 87, the first day of WFAN, I said on the air that night that if I get fired, and I know from failure over a career that began in the 60s. I did TV for 17 years and lost one job getting fired. The boss's wife didn't like my left eyebrow moving up and my right eyebrow staying level with parallel to my eye, if you can believe. Something weird and strange. But I know from failure, and that makes any success you have that much more where you appreciate that. And you want to be good at doing what you do, but you have to be very lucky. But getting back to the point, that very first night I said, if I get fired from this job, it won't be for lack of effort. Mm-hmm. And yes, you want to be good no matter what you're doing, whether it's broadcasting or construction or whether you're the butcher, the baker, or the candlestick maker. No matter what you do, you want to be good, but you also have to be a little bit lucky. So I was good most nights, thank goodness. Not good all nights, but I was certainly lucky enough to come back the next day and be better doing what I was doing.
Nice. I also read, Steve, you did one of the last interviews with Mark Koenig. Now, you younger kids and you younger folks out there can Google Mark Koenig. At the time, he was the last living member of the 1927 Yankees, who are always mentioned as one of the greatest nines in the history of baseball. So tell us about that interview, Steve. What was the gentleman like?
Well, he was terrific, and obviously he was, you know, on the last lap of his life. But he was lucid, he was articulate, and again, even with my mother-in-law, who was 96, if you start talking to older people, their memory may not be the same. My memory is not the same. But when you're talking to somebody really on the very aging or old side, if you talk to them about their youth, then all of a sudden their memory comes to life. And that's the way it was with Mark Koenig. He also, on the road, roomed with Babe Ruth. And the Yankees, during that time in the 20s and early 30s, had a curfew of 11 o'clock. And Mark Koenig laughingly told us that the Babe, if he was home by 11, if he was by 11 o'clock back at the hotel, he was with maybe not one, but two women, and most of the time he wasn't back by 11 o'clock at all. No. Much too early for the Bambino.
I think, Steve, my claims to fame, the last interview, I believe, with Ed Herman. Remember Ed Herman, the catcher with the Chicago White Sox?
The name is familiar, yes.
Ed Herman and Jim Marshall, the skipper of the Chicago Cubs, who was a 1962 Met.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so I got to those gentlemen before they left us. And we are speaking with the great Steve Summers tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, you spent some time doing middays with Russ Salzberg, and folks may remember the sweater and the schmoozer. Tell us about the middays, Steve.
Yes.
You guys had success.
Well, working with Russ. It was 5 years, and in the very beginning, I didn't want to do it because I was very, very happy overnight. That may sound strange to a lot of people, but I was being accepted. The audience was butchers, bakers, candlestick makers. I'm the son of a grocer. So I felt a connection with them. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, they felt some connection with me. And again, it was fun. I was able to experiment and do some creative and innovative things with music, as long as it had a sports connection. I was doing monologues and production. Now, when I joined Russ, and I really didn't want to go 10-1, that was going to be at the time after Imus and before Mike and the Mad Dog, so you knew you were going to have some kind of an audience after Imus at 10 a.m. and before Mike and the Mad Dog coming up at 1, and Russ by himself really didn't have ratings. And so they wanted to do a good cop, bad cop kind of pairing. He was a little more, you know, yelling and hanging up on people and not accepting at very first your opinion as opposed to his. So, and I wasn't able to begin the program with the monologue, nor was I, in the beginning, able to play any production. And so I felt a little bit, you know, compromised. But the ratings went up when I joined him. And I always said on the air that working with Russ was like working with the Addams family. It was like working with the Manson family because he was very rough around the edges. He was working at Channel 9.
Right.
And John Minko, who did updates at WFAN, he once said, and I think accurately so, that Russ had really looked at Channel 9 as his primary job and WFAN as his part-time job. But by the 5 years that the two of us were working together from 95 to 2000, the ratings were very, very good. And then, of course, they became a little bit stale, but we were always in the top five in our demographic in that time period.
That's all that matters, Steve, is what the book says. That's all that matters. Now, I think you'll agree, and most of the guys in this business, Steve, that the stars of the show are usually the callers. Now, anybody who tries to make themselves the star, we know some of those folks around. Let's talk about some of the more famous denizens of the dark who filled the air at the Fan, your all-time greatest callers.
Well, my all-time greatest caller, who also ended up co-hosting with me, it was Jerry Seinfeld. And there are over the 25, 30 years plus that I worked at the Fan, I mean, we were exchanging emails back and forth, and a lot of those emails are in the book. And, of course, he called in as a Jerry from Queens way back in the early days and co-hosted with me on a couple of occasions. But you're absolutely correct, and they are listed in the book by name. There were so many callers that I became friends with, went to their weddings with, even to this day. But Doris from Regal Park had elephant's disease, and she was homebound, a diehard Metropolitan Fan, and she called a lot, and not just to me, but mostly to me, but to some of the other shows as well. And I'll tell you this, the New York Times, as you know, Bill, in their very final Sunday in December, in their Sunday magazine, they note people who died that year. And I'll go back to 2003 when Doris from Regal Park, in Queens, of course, when she died, the New York Times Sunday magazine, last Sunday in 2003, had a full page on Doris from Regal Park celebrating her callership to WFAN. And there were other, the New York Times also wrote one time about Short Al from Brooklyn. There was a Bender at Ebbets Field. There was Vinnie from Queens and Stephanie from Manhattan and, you know, Herb from Connecticut and just so many callers who became somewhat celebrities themselves. They called, they were interesting, they were fun. And what they did, Bill, and this is important for you, for me, for anybody who does what we do, and that is that they give us a chance, that they give us the opportunity. And with me, and you too, they give you a breath. They give you a life. They give you a career. They give you a lifestyle. And for that, you have to always be grateful to the audience that you have.
Some tremendous folks through the years that you mentioned, Steve. Yeah. And as you said, they became stars in their own right.
And, oh, yes.
They knew their stuff, too. Doris really knew her baseball. She loved the Mets.
Yes.
Yeah. She was great. We are speaking with the Schmoozer tonight, Steve Summers. New book coming out, is it the 18th, Steve?
Well, no. Let me do the shameless plug.
Sure.
It'll only take about a half hour. No, I'm just kidding. It comes out November 25th.
Okay.
The reason it was moved from the 18th of this month to the 25th is they ran out of books at Amazon. There were 300,000 looks once it was posted. So let me say this. You can pre-order now on Amazon. The link is at my Twitter or X page, at Steve Summers, WFAN. Book signings will be finalized on social media, on WFAN, and my podcast, which is called Me Here, You There at 660gmail.com. com. But again, great. You can pre-order the book on Amazon, the link, at my Twitter or X page, at Steve Summers, WFAN, and social media, and WFAN, and my podcast will all announce book signings once they are finalized. I know I'm going to be at a number of Barnes & Noble books for signings, and there are some others in the works and some others that are planned, and they will be made available for those interested in finding out. And I'm hoping, even if some people don't buy the book, that they come by to say hello. That has always been, as it is with you too, mm-hmm. a perk of what we do, you know, for what we have been doing for a living. And that is, I mean, money, well, you certainly want to make some money. And most people, and you probably know this too, Bill, most people think we make a lot more money than we do, unless you're Howard Stern, unless you're, you know, the late Don Imus, right. unless you're Stephen A. Smith, I mean, unless you're Chris Russo and Mike Francesa, they were huge revenue getters, and so they made big, big money at WFAN, and they still do, because they were the best show that I've ever heard with Sports Talk, Bill. Mike and the Mad Dog, you may not have liked them.
Right.
You know, you may not have, I mean, Russo is more user-friendly than Francesa, but together they didn't like each other for a long time, but together that dislike for each other gave them an edge and gave them, you know, a lot to listen for in their 19 years together at WFA, and it was a must-listen.
It made for great radio, Steve. That's for sure.
Yes.
Me here, you there, from Triumph Books, coming out the 25th, folks. We hope that you come out here, Steve, so we can stop by and see you. We spoke about Mark Koenig. Who were some of your other memorable interviews that you've had through the years?
Well, I mean, there were so many. Muhammad Ali.
Wow.
I was in the ring with him. There's a picture of it. And this was in Atlanta when I was doing TV in the late 70s and early 80s. And he came to Georgia, did Ali, because Georgia was the first state to reinstate his boxing license after he refused to go to Vietnam. And so for charity, for the Atlanta Boys and Girls Club, he decided to get in the ring with some of the sportscasters in town.
Uh-huh.
And he chose the three sportscasters on TV, and I was one of them. And here's the thing. Did he hit me? No, he did not. And I could not hit him, as he did a little rope-a-dope with me. And I told him, don't you dare try to hit me, because I know how to duck.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. So that was a nice moment. Phil Rizzuto, now I'm a major metropolitan fan, but Rizzuto was on with me a number of times. It was like talking to your grandfather, and he was like that with everybody. And he was also the last Yankee to bunt, by the way. I always used to say that on the air. He was the American League Most Valuable Player in 1950, and he was a great bunter and a great shortstop. But there were so many interviews done over the years. But it's interesting you bring up Mark Koenig, because he was the shortstop, batting number 8 for those 1927 New York Yankees, and also from San Francisco. And here's the interesting thing. When the Giants and Dodgers first moved west, everyone thought that the Dodgers would have struggles in L.A., because when Sandy Koufax, and they would prove it to some degree, because when Sandy Koufax was once throwing a no-hitter, a number of thousands of Dodger fans at Dodger Stadium left the ballpark to beat the traffic on the way home. Metropolitan fans, Yankee fans, would never, ever leave a no-hitter, or really any game they're at, unless maybe they have an appointment or, God forbid, an emergency.
Right.
But the bottom line is that the San Francisco Giants really, the San Francisco Seals, where Joe DiMaggio played, where Lazzari played, where Grossetti played, Lefty Gomez, they were all from the San Francisco area, especially, you know, Joe DiMaggio, who the Yankee Clipper, and so the Giants fans. Now, I went to the very first game with the Giants and the Dodgers, the very first game the two teams played on the West Coast. I was young. I went with my uncle, who was a dentist, pulled my baby teeth out with his hands, and it's never been the same for me going to a dentist since. The scars, the mental scars from that. But I was, my uncle told me years later that I was asking on that very first game between the Giants and the Dodgers at Seals Stadium, where the AAA team had played, where DiMaggio had played. The San Francisco Seals were the AAA team in the old Pacific Coast League. Anyway, my uncle reminded me years later, after being at that opener with the Giants and Dodgers, why I kept asking, are the New York Giants playing their home games in San Francisco?
Yeah.
I couldn't, you know, you're not talking to the brightest guy on the block, Bill. And I just couldn't understand why the San Francisco Giants, why they were called the San Francisco Giants coming from New York.
Right.
They were on the road. They were on the road to me. Where were the San Francisco Seals? I cried when I finally figured out that they were not going to be playing baseball anymore.
Yeah. Oh, man. That is amazing, Steve. Yeah. I got so much more to ask you, Steve. Will you come back in the future?
Oh, anytime, Bill. And again, I probably talked to you earlier.
We loved it.
I hope not. But I can't thank you enough for having me. And later on tonight, I'm going to be on Channel 4 with Bruce Beck. So you're giving me a chance to not only plug my book, but also on Channel 4. And I think he does like a sports wrap-up. We're taping it about 9:30. So the bottom line is I'll be on Channel 4 with another shameless plug. And again, the book is out November 25th. And thank you so much. A real honor and real pleasure for allowing me to give the shameless plug for the book and to talk with a true icon himself with Long Island Radio. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here at Sports Talk New York, Steve. Again, folks, as Steve says, on the 25th, me here, you there, my three decades overnight, under the cover schmoozing sports as Captain Midnight for WFAN. I will let you folks know about the appearances, the book signings, if you can't get out to Steve's social media. The book is available, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Great holiday gift for your favorite sports fan, folks. Steve, thanks again. We'll look for you tonight on with Bruce Beck.
Okay, the face for radio on TV is the way it goes.
That's it.
Thank you for having me again, and always the very best to you and your audience as well. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
That is the great Steve Summers, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in the legendary Hall of Fame defenseman from the New York Rangers, Brad Park. Stick around, folks. Get it? Stick? Hockey? Brian loved that one. All right, folks. Doo-doo.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB AM/FM Radio, live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island, New York, USA, North America, planet Earth, Milky Way Galaxy. Just for those who might be out in space that want to tune in, there you go. I hope everyone's well, enjoying the program tonight. Well, I just want to remind you the World Series well in the rearview mirror. The awards have all been awarded. Nothing to do now but wait for the winter meetings in December and stoke the flames of the hot stove, as we call it. We want to see who signs where, for how long, and for how much. The free agents, possible trades. But also, I want to remind you the upcoming Hall of Fame vote, not referring to the January Baseball Writers' Annual Vote. It's the Contemporary Baseball Era Ballot. Eight former big league players comprise the ballot. It has to do with candidates whose primary contributions to the game came since 1980. Now, that'll be done on Sunday, December 7th. They'll have the results on the MLB Network at, I believe, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The guys that they'll be discussing and voting on: Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, very interesting there, Carlos Delgado, Jeff Kent, Don Mattingly, Dale Murphy, Gary Sheffield, and Fernando Valenzuela. Just food for thought. I know you could make a valid case for all of these guys. All of them are alive except for Fernando. Not sure who will comprise the committee. I'll let you guys know as soon as I see something on that. Anyway, you now have the pro and college football going on, the NBA in full swing, the NHL well underway. I got to tell you, folks, the Isles' number one draft pick, Matthew Schaefer, he looks like the real deal, really showing the rest of the NHL something. So keep your eye on Matthew. We'll move on, and now let's stick with hockey. Our next guest has been called the greatest defenseman, one of the greatest defensemen of his era, a nine-time All-Star, elected to the Hockey Hall of Fame in 1988. In 2017, he was named as one of the 100 greatest NHL players of all time. I'd like to welcome back to Sports Talk New York, Brad Park. Brad, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Doing wonderful, sir. Glad to have you with us. Now, you grew up in Scarborough, Ontario. Now, who were your teams and your heroes back then, Brad?
Well, Scarborough is a borough of Toronto, so I grew up in Toronto, basically. So I was grew up a huge Leaf fan.
Wow. Okay. And favorite players? Who would you say?
Well, you know, kind of like Gordie Howe, Rocky Richard, and as I got into playing junior teams, I was looking at defensemen that were really good at my position, and the guys that I looked at were Tim Horton, Bobby Bond, and J.C. Tremblay.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, some really great names there. Now, your dad was a referee and a coach, and you guys used to really talk defense together and get strategy taken care of.
Yeah, my dad was kind of he coached me all the way through minor hockey, and he was a real student of the game, and he would as peewees, when he coached the team, we had like chalkboard sessions, mm-hmm, on breakout plays and things like that. So he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That's great to have your dad that's interested and takes the time to coach you like that. That you got to the New York Rangers in 1968. I'd like to know, Brad, what were your impressions of Madison Square Garden and New York City as a whole?
Well, it was a little bit overwhelming, walking into the new garden had just come into effect in February that year, and I remember going in there for an exhibition game against Montreal and just looking around at the size of the building and the size of the crowd. It was kind of breathtaking, and, before the game I was extremely nervous, but once the game started, I really settled down.
We're speaking with Brad Park tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, you became a favorite with the fans and the medium media as an offensive defenseman, as they call it. To whom do you attribute that style of play, that you were an offensive defenseman? Was that your dad?
Well, I never played defense until I was 15. I was a left winger, forward.
Ah, okay.
And I had, I had those offensive skills as an 8-year-old or 9-year-old. I was the guy that went through everybody, stick handling and things like that. Playing on outdoor rinks with a huge crowd was always a challenge. So I had these offensive skills, and I looked at Bobby Bond, who was a real hard hitter. Timmy Horton would lug the puck, and he would make a deke just to make a good pass. And J.C. Tremblay was a magician. And I said, I want a little piece of each of one of those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not bad, as I said. Great names. And, folks, you heard Brad mention Tim Horton. Great hockey player, a Hall of Famer. Not just a donut, as the shops are opening up down here, Brad. And, people wonder who Tim Horton is, and I try to tell as many people as I can just who the gentleman was. And that's that. You drew comparisons to Bobby Orr, Brad, which is not really a bad thing. How did you deal with the comparisons at first?
Well, I think Bobby and I are the same age. He came in as an 18-year-old, and I came in as a 20-year-old, and the comparisons never bothered me because, if he was the best player in the game, being number two to him is not a bad thing.
No, not at all. Considered by many to be the greatest player ever to put on skates. That's Bobby Orr. Now, there was a playoff series with the Boston Bruins, Brad, and our old buddy Phil Esposito he was quoted as saying, if the Rangers think they're going to beat us, they're full of park spelled backward. Now, it's kind of an interesting quote. It means, though, you're getting into this guy's head.
Well, Phil and I, we would butt heads at that time. It was one thing. I never, if I had a chance to take a shot at Phil, I definitely took the shot. I wouldn't pass it up. And, but he was a, he was 72. We played them in the finals. They beat us in six games. And Bobby Orr was really the difference. But the surprising thing is that nobody understands that Phil never scored a goal in the finals because he had to play against Walter Kachuk, and Walter made sure that he wasn't going to get any goals.
Ah, yeah, Walt Kachuk. I remember all of you guys. Before I became an Islander fan in 1972, I was a big Ranger fan, and my dad used to take me to Skateland over on Hillside Avenue in New Hyde Park. And I remember one day we went, and I went to Catholic school, and it was a Catholic holiday, and none of the public school kids were around. They were all in school. So I was about the only kid in the place watching you guys practice, and I remember I had a little notepad with me, and I just waited outside the locker room, and every guy to a man signed that pad for me, and I still have that. And just a great memory of all you guys.
Yeah, we used to enjoy that. Skateland was in New Hyde Park, and we would get a crowd there all the time to come and watch. So they were terrific to us, and we just returned the favor. That's all.
Yeah, a great place, folks. An old time rink, no glass. It was fencing all around the ends, and just a great place to watch the guys practice. You could get hit with some ice off the skates too. You were so close to the players. Now, you were the youngest Ranger captain ever, 26 years old, Brad. That had to be a big honor.
It was an honor. I had Bobby Nevin was my first captain with the Rangers, and Vic Hadfield, and they traded Vic, and I think it was at Rod's wedding, and Emil Francis came up to me and he says, "I want you to be the captain," and I said, "I don't want to be the captain. Give it to Rod," and he says, "Nope, I'm not going to do that. I'll pick somebody else, but I'm not giving it to Rod." And I went and talked to Rod about it. I said, "Rod, the cat asked you to be captain, but I want you to be," and Rod says, "No, you got to take it. You got to take it." So it was with his blessing that I went back to the CAD and said, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah. The CAD folks, of course, the great, another Hall of Famer, Emil Francis, who was coach and general manager of the Rangers back in those days. Now, the WHA came along, Brad, the World Hockey Association. The kids and the younger folks can Google that. It was an upstart league, sort of like the ABA in a way, but not as successful. They tried to raid the rosters of the NHL. I think they tried to get you, Brad. Some players jumped. You didn't. What was the impact that the WHA had on the NHL?
Well, at that time there was no free agency, so basically you could not move from one team to the other without the blessing of your team, or they would trade you. That was the only way you could move, and it really held down your negotiation value, right? So I had finished my fourth year. I made, as a first round pick, my first year I made $10,000. My second year I made $11,000, and then I had to hold out to get 32.5. And then 45, and when the WHA came along, the Rangers offered me $100,000, and I went to the WHA, contacted me, and I negotiated a deal for a 5-year deal for $300,000. And I was hours from going, and I told them I got to go back and just talk to Emil Francis, and I called the CAD and told him what they had offered me, and he said, "Well, but I'll stay in New York for $250 for 5 years." And he says, "Well, I don't think you'll get that. I won't advise it. I'll tell the Ranger management that I'm not in favor of it." And he went and talked to Bill Jennings, and then he came back and he says, "Okay, we'll do that." So
nice.
I immediately became the highest paid guy in the NHL at that time.
A lot of money back in those days, folks. That was good. These WHA teams in New York, it was the Raiders, I believe, the New York Raiders. And these guys...
You have to remember that the federal tax back then was 50%.
Yeah.
And then you had the state and the city tax. So if I took home 115 of the 250, that was a lot.
Yeah, right. Taxes were rating you like the WHA. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the Summit Series, Brad. I always enjoy watching clips and talking to guys about the Summit Series in 1972. What that was, folks, is the NHL or the Canadian players playing against the Soviets. Now, Bobby Orr sat out with a knee injury, and you were the top defenseman in the series.
Yeah, there was an 8-game series, 4 games in Canada, and 4 games in Moscow. And it was the first time that it was an NHL team, because they wouldn't let WHA players play. So a guy like Bobby Hall or Jerry Cheevers or Derek Sanderson, J.C. Tron, they weren't allowed to play. And so we had 35 guys at camp, and we lost the first game in Toronto, won the second one, tied one, and then we lost in Vancouver. So now we go to Moscow and we lose the first game. So we would have to win the last three in order to win the series. And we won game 6, we won game 7, and we ended up winning game 8 with 34 seconds to go.
Yeah, that was amazing. What a great series, folks. Well, as I said, Google that if you can, the 1972 Summit Series, the Canadians against the Soviets, not the Russians yet. They were Soviets back then. Now, 75-76, Brad. Brad Park with us tonight. Bad season for the Rangers. Emil Francis starts to unload guys. He sends you, Jean Rattel, and Joe Zanussi to Boston for Esposito and Carol Vadney. Now, people were shocked by that. How did you feel about that deal?
Well, you have to understand that the playoffs in 75 was we lost a 2 out of 3 to the Islanders, and Boston lost a 2 out of 3 to Chicago. And two of the best teams get knocked out in a short series. So the NHL was the last time they ever did a 2 out of 3. And the higher-ups in the Gulf and Western had ordered Emil Francis to disperse the team. Mm-hmm. And he started in the summer with sending Jerry Butler and Teddy Irvin and Burr Wilson to St. Louis for John Davidson and Billy Collins. And then in the fall, Jockman went on waivers. Vladimir went to Chicago. And then in November, we played a game in Vancouver. We won it. I think Ratty was first star. I was second. And the next morning, I get a call at 7:30 asked by Ron Stewart, the coach, to come to his room. And as soon as I put the phone down, I told Steve Vickers, mm-hmm. I just got traded.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, I cried, you know. And,
yeah.
At first I said I wasn't going to go, and then I said, what do you mean? That's my livelihood. And but I was very upset about it. Then I went to Boston, and I got mad that I was traded.
Yeah. All my autographs went down the drain, Brad. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. Now, the Rangers were still mired at the bottom after that deal. So the Cat wasn't doing too well there. The Bruins, though, they were rejuvenated. Despite they lost Esposito and Bobby Orr went to Chicago, and the Cat was fired. Did you feel that you had to fill Bobby Orr's skates in Boston, Brad?
Well, I played 10 games with Bobby, and we lost the first one, but I think we won 9 in a row. The power play was close to 50%. We were winning good, and then Bobby went out. We're going to Chicago, and he's coming off the plane, and I'm going on. And usually when Bobby went out, the Bruins would go into a tailspin, but with John Rattel and myself, we kept going up. So by we got to January, we were in first place from last place.
Yeah, not too bad. How did Rattel feel about that trade? Do you know, Brad? Because he was a stellar New York Ranger, and he did really well in Boston as well.
No, John was a great two-way player.
Yeah.
Great offensively, great defensively. And he was 34, and, you know, he was just, as was Phil. And, you know, he just bossed him in there. You know, he was such a great guy, you know, with the young guys and working with them and educating them. You know, I played 13 years with him, and I had a blast.
A great player, John Rattel, folks, another Hall of Famer. Now, Don Cherry was the coach of the Bruins when you got there, Brad, and he told you to concentrate on your D.
Well, you can say something like that. He said, look, I don't want you rushing the puck.
Yeah.
And I said, really, why? He said, well, if you rush the puck through the first two periods, you'll be dragging, your ass will be dragging by the time you get to the third period.
Yeah.
Now, understand, I'm going to be playing you 35 to 40 minutes a game. I want you to control our half of center ice. And with 10 minutes to go, if we're tied or behind, you got a green light. Mm-hmm. And I said, you're going to play me 35, 40 minutes a game? He said, yeah. I said, well, all right, I'll sit back until, you know. And, you know, we dressed 5 defensemen in no time, and we only played 4. So, you know, I was doing power play, killing penalties, regular shifts. So he lived up to his word.
Now, you weren't too well-liked in Boston before the trade because of being an arch-rival New York Ranger. But you won the fans over up in Boston.
Yeah, I think it was a question of, you know, once they saw me and what I could do and what my skills were and, you know, how we produced, you know, the Don Cherry area was a lunch pail game. We were the biggest toughest, meanest sons of bitches in the valley. and I got really good at killing penalties.
Yeah. And the fans, as I said, endeared themselves to you. Now, you ran out of gas one time, as a matter of fact. Excuse me. And a couple of guys came to your aid. You told them you were Brad Park, and bingo, they helped you out, right?
Well, it was a snowy night in Boston. We're on the way home, and my wife had driven in. She didn't have time to get any gas, so we're on the way home, and we're about a mile and a half, just got off the ramp on from the highway, and we're out of gas. And her parents are with us, right? So I get out, and I flag these two kids down, and I say, look, we're out of gas. Can you give us a ride to the head of our street? And, I mean, the snow is like 6 inches, hasn't been plowed. And they said, sure, we can do that. So I said, on the way there to my back to my house, I said, look, are you guys Bruins fans? And they said, yeah. I said, well, my name's Brad Park, and I play for the Bruins. And we're playing here on Saturday night at home. And I want your name, and I'll have two tickets for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Nice.
And so they were tickled pink.
Yeah. What a great story that is. We're speaking with the great Brad Park tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, the biggest goal of your career, I thought it might be in 83, the playoff overtime goal versus the Sabres. What was the biggest goal you scored in your career, Brad?
Well, I think that overtime goal was a great highlight. It really was. But, you know, winning the Summit Series, in 72 and playing for your country was probably a bigger thrill for me.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that, definitely. Now, you had Ray Bourque with you for a while on the Bruins, another great Hall of Fame defenseman. Did you help bringing him along at all? Give him any tips, Brad?
Oh, yeah. Ray came in 79, and I became his mentor for 4 years and really worked with him on accelerating the learning process of what works and why it works and things that he had to do to get better. And he was just a sponge, and he took everything in, and he developed into a terrific, terrific defenseman.
He did. What a credit to you that is. Now, in 84, Brad, you win the Bill Masterson Trophy, which folks may not know is for perseverance in the game of hockey. Was that a highlight of your career, Brad?
Yeah, I think so. My second son was born with cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And so I had done a lot of charity work on behalf of them. So I think that the charity work and everything I'd done like that is probably one of the reasons, why I got the Bill Masterson. But it was a great honor.
That is a great award to win, folks, the Bill Masterson Trophy. Now, when you were with the Wings and you retired, Brad, you became head coach of the Detroit Red Wings for a while. That was back in 1985. Did you want to get into coaching? Were you reluctant? Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I retired, and I was doing some broadcasting. And Mike Ilitch, the owner of the Red Wings, the team was struggling. And he asked me to come back and coach. And I said, okay, I will do it for you. I still had a house in Detroit, so that made things easier. And, they gave me a last-place club, and I was good enough to keep it there.
Yeah, yeah. No, they weren't sitting on top of the world, the Red Wings, back in 1985. That's for sure. How about broadcasting behind the mic, Brad? How'd you get into that, and did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. I get I was doing ESPN. I was doing CTV in Canada. Actually, did the CTV did the Olympics in '88. From Calgary, and so I enjoyed that. So I'd hit the road for 2 or 3 days at the end of each week, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I enjoyed it. It kept me in the game, and I worked with some great people.
I had also read while I was doing some research, Brad, that when you started out, playing for the Toronto Marlboros back in the day. You had laid a heavy check on the son of Punch Imlach, and that got you some attention. Is that true?
Well, I was I played junior B for one of the Maple Leafs teams. It was junior B, and they didn't invite me to junior A camp, and they invited me to junior B camp. But I had an invite from Hamilton, which was the Red Wings organization, to go to their junior A camp. And my parents got Jim Gregory to pull the rug out from under me, so I was the last guy invited to camp with the Marlies. And I had I didn't have two gloves that match. I didn't have two shin pads that match. I didn't have two elbow pads that match. I had the worst underwear. And when I got to training camp, I was pissed.
Yeah.
Right? Because I felt like a token. And my first shift is a center iceman on, you know, in the scrimmage, the center iceman face off in their end, tips the puck and starts skating out. And usually a defenseman will back out. And I said, no, I went in and I knocked him out. And it happened to be Brent Imlach, who was the son of Maple Leafs coach and general manager, Punch Imlach. So
yeah,
it was more of an angry thing at the Marlies, not at Brent.
Gotcha. All right. Now, you were voted to the Hockey Hall of Fame 1988, first year of eligibility. You can't do much better than that, Brad.
No, it was great. I happened to go into the hall with Guy Lafleur and Tony Esposito. So,
wow.
Yeah, they're two great guys, great players. And so it was a real honor. And it was in Toronto, which is my hometown. My parents were there, my aunt and uncle and everything. And the Hall of Fame at that time was in the process of moving from one facility to another, so there was really no Hall of Fame. I couldn't even go and look at my picture.
Oh, gee. Yeah, I've never been to the Hockey Hall. I hope to get up there this summer. That's one of my bucket list items. Well, Brad, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here at Sports Talk New York. I wish all the best to you and the family, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
That's Brad Park, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that will do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my tremendous guests, Steve Summers and Brad Park, my engineer Brian Graves, and of course you guys. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you next time for more Sports Talk New York. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.